Hi, and welcome to the 45th episode of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm John Neff.
I'm Damon Lawrence.
And today we have an extra special guest, Alex Nunez, one of the team members of Autoblog, is here to join us today. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, guys.
I don't think we've ever had three people on a single podcast. Of course, I've never listened to the podcast, actually, so I can only remember back so far. But it's going to be a fun time. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we begin, I do want to give Volvo, who is the sponsor of the Autoblog podcast, a chance to say a few words.
The Volvo XC70 and XC90 deliver the ideal combination of versatility and comfort. They are both rugged and dependable, and come equipped with Volvo's advanced safety features. Visit www.volvocars.us for more information.
All right, and we're back. And one of the reasons Alex is on the show today is because we're gonna kick off talking about a post that I did this week on Ford. And we know Ford has been a pretty common topic on the Autoblog podcast, but if you'll bear with us, we're going to visit it one more time. And the post I wrote was called "What If Ford Had Made All the Right Moves?" And it sprung from a conversation that Alex and I had on Instant Messenger after I had seen the latest Ford Bold Moves web-based documentary episode. And do you want to describe the conversation we had on IM? Because it got about as heated and frustrated as an IM conversation could be, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, it all stemmed from the fact that, you know, the Fairlane looks like it's going to be perfectly nice and everything, but it seems completely redundant based on a lot of the other product in the lineup. And it kind of just devolved from there.
Yeah, and I think what had set me off was watching the documentary. They are shooting footage of Mark Fields, who says something like, you know, we all know how desperate we are for this product. And it just irritated me, because if you're desperate for that product, for the Fairlane, this kind of giant thing that doesn't really want to be a minivan, if that's the product you think you're desperate for, then you have way bigger problems than we ever thought you did. So our conversation kind of began there, but evolved into, at least in my head, what lineup I think Ford should have today if it had made the right moves 3, 5, 7 years ago, rather than the wrong ones that led to the situation they're in now. So I basically made my dream lineup for 2007 for Ford, and it centers around the Ford 427 concept, which was shown at the 2003 Detroit Auto Show. And for those of you who don't remember, think a Ford-badged Chrysler 300. It's a large rear-wheel drive sedan, slab-sided. I think it was the first time we ever saw the three-bar grill. Can you guys think of anything?
I think you're right about that.
Yeah,
it was the first appearance of that grill.
It was the introduction of that grill. It looked great. It looked simple. And basically, in my head, this was Ford's opportunity to go down the right path, and by actually producing this as kind of their flagship sedan. And I even postulate you could even imagine that a 427, a production version, would eventually replace the Crown Victoria, which, you know, is probably the most difficult vehicle in the entire automotive industry to replace right now. I mean, I truly think they're just going to keep building it forever and ever. But this could have been a viable kind of transition car from it.
Well, especially when the 300C came out, what, the following year. You know, obviously the concept was there. They could have beat them to the punch to a certain degree. Granted, I'm sure Chrysler had, you know, everything lined up as far as the 300C was concerned. But as popular as that was over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years, it seems like it could have been a viable contender in there.
Right, and I don't understand why, even right at that moment, I mean, I think the 300C came out of the gate very strong. Ford could have made the decision to go with it, but instead we get the Ford 500, which is this extremely large Passat-looking thing that has a engine that's too small for its size. Boring looks, you know.
It's completely anonymous on the road.
Very
anonymous,
yeah.
No, it's the American interpretation of European styling, which just did not go over well, unfortunately.
And quite honestly, I think the 427 should be in that spot. And my idea was to move the 500, or actually just cancel the 500, but let the Montego live on, the Mercury version. Because basically, Mercury has to have a vehicle of its own. If Ford wants to demonstrate that it believes in Mercury, it has to give that brand something that isn't a complete clone of a Ford product. It's not something they're doing now, and it's not something I think they're going to do, but I'm just saying that's what they need to do if they want this brand to have any chance of a success.
Alex, I've already made my opinion clear about Mercury that I think it should just be killed off. What's your take on that?
It's hard. I mean, I'm kind of with John on this. I think Mercury would be fine as long as they gave it unique product. But Mercury as an assemblage of, you know, Fords with slightly different badges is pointless. As is, it's currently pointless. I mean, there's no reason to go buy a Mercury unless you really want that, you know, that grill. You know,
if you're making a buying decision based on a grill, then you have no business buying a car.
That's an entirely separate conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. But if Mercury had the Montego all to itself, and then let's say Mercury also had a version of the Freestyle, which is, you know, the 7-passenger station wagon / CUV thing, that's two products all its own that would free up room for the 427 at Ford, and then also the new Fairlane concept that's going to be produced. I mean, basically, the Fairlane is redundant because of the Freestyle. So if the Freestyle were moved over to Mercury, and it would, you know, they made a version, a concept called the Meta 1 that was a Mercury-badged Freestyle, you know, that really solves, or at least diminishes, the redundancy a lot, you know, and gives them a reason to keep producing the Montego and the Freestyle.
Do you think Mercury could maybe move away from the pensioner's car perception and maybe pull like a Pontiac and turn into a performance division for Ford?
No. You have to give it a Cougar first.
Even if you gave it a Cougar, I don't think.
I mean,
I think we're too Cougar.
You
know. I think we're just way too far removed from that. I mean, I think you could give it a Cougar based on the Mustang, and that would be great and sweet, and people would buy it. But that's not going to drag forth the brand. I mean, you couldn't build a performance car based on the Montego. And, you know, I just think Mercury has built a reputation of anonymity, you know, and you can play off that, you know. It could be the Buick of Ford, and you can make money selling those, but you can't make money when you're just rebadging so blatantly. I mean, we ripped on GM for doing this for years with so many vehicles, and really Ford's been doing it the entire time too, and keeps doing it. Below that, though, my dream lineup, I actually keep the Ford Fusion in Ford's lineup. I think the Fusion is a good car. It's doing well, and despite everyone's wish to bring over the Ford Mondeo from Europe, the new one, which, you know, looks like a fantastic vehicle, which is about all we can say of it right now, I think the Fusion's doing fine, and I think it'll continue to do fine. So that's actually, I think, one smart move by Ford. Of course, now, spreading that car over three brands and diluting it, I'm not going to say is a very smart idea, but they seem to be keeping their heads above water with it. Below the Fusion, though, things get messy again very quickly. Of course, the Ford Focus, which we've dealt with a lot on this show in the past. Obviously, the Euro Focus should be here by now, and that's just a fact. You know, I don't know how many times we converse about that.
I'm very concerned about what the Gillette Grill Focus is going to wind up being, the one that's, you know, the mule that we've been posting spy shots of and that kind of stuff.
It looks like a warmed over version of the current model, and I think, you know, I asked in the post, or I postulated, that the Focus right now is like the oldest compact car in the market. Everything else has been substantially redesigned, if not completely redesigned, and I think someone mentioned the only other one that hasn't is the Toyota Corolla, but that's it. And instead of giving it a complete redesign, they're going to give it basically new clothes, you know, and maybe retune some dampers and you know, it not give it an all new car. It needs to be the C1 based Euro Focus here, whatever the cost, whatever the price. It needs to be here. I think people can take a more expensive Focus if it's actually better, which the Eurofocus is, and of course you need to give them something smaller and less expensive under that, and Ford has absolutely nothing there right now. And my idea is to bring over the Fiesta, which I think is a great car from Europe and a perfect size. It's kind of just the size of a Mini, which is good. I don't really think U.S. producers want to go much smaller than that right now. So I don't understand what's Ford's hesitation of using that as the basis for a small car over here.
Why the Fiesta over the Ka, by the way? Just styling-wise or size-wise?
Size-wise, I think the Ka is too small. I think there is a point where a vehicle is too small for the U.S. market to really be adopted by the largest number of people. I think people will look at the size of a car and think, if I get hit by an SUV with that, I'm dead. You know? And so I think that the Fiesta kind of just gives them a shot at living, whereas the Ka,
confidence-inspiring, yeah.
Yeah, I think of the Ka, people would just look, and I'm not saying that's true, you know, maybe you can get hit with an SUV of the Ka and live, and that's all good, but I think in people's heads, they don't see that. And I think the Fairlane concept, again, the Fairlane concept would be good if the Freestyle weren't here, but the Freestyle's here, so what is the point?
And the Edge is here, too. We neglected to mention that, which is another crossover. I mean, how many can you have?
Right, and basically the only difference is well, not the only difference, but I mean the Edge doesn't have a third row, the Freestyle does, the Fairlane will. I mean, Jesus, there's three vehicles that like do the same thing. But we should actually tell people where Damon is at right now. Tell them where you're at, Damon.
Actually, yeah, I just returned from the little press junket for the launching of the Edge in San Francisco, California, and just got done with it yesterday, and actually the review of it should be up tomorrow. And overall, it was a nice 2 days. The Ford took care of us very, very well. The car itself, though, It definitely fits into the segment that it's designed for. There's no doubt about that. They've got it broken down, so it's basically filling every possible market that it can, in the sense that every demographic they're trying to aim for, they're trying to go for, baby boomers that are in their 60s that, you know, have a problem with ease of movement and that kind of thing. They're looking for people that are downgrading or upgrading, depending on your perspective, from SUVs with gas prices.
And does that diminish the results, though? I mean, if they're trying to hit so many different demographics, does that turn it off to all of them?
They got this broad swath. I would say no. First off, because I think there's, unless it gets a perception as being a pensioner's car, or if it gets a perception of just being, kind of this only urban vehicle, or if it gets something like that, then it could become a problem. But I think that it's got enough appeal. It's a perfectly average vehicle that's going to fit the majority of the population. And with that many demographics being aimed at, I think it's got a pretty good chance. The biggest problem that I kind of came away with, the car itself, I think overall was pretty good. The new 3.5 liter, by the way, I'll let you both know that in that vehicle just doesn't quite come up to task. The new transmission, they've got a 6-speed unit in there, and that's perfection. Probably one of the nicest transmissions I've encountered in a Ford for several years.
And I believe that's the one they developed with GM.
That is the exact one they developed with GM. You're exactly right, yeah. But like I said, the new 3.5 liter, granted this thing's just over 2 tons, depending on whether it's front-wheel drive or all-wheel drive. And but you put your foot into the gas pedal, and it definitely has to think about it before it starts getting underway.
Did you drive an all-wheel drive version or front-wheel drive, or both?
I drove both, as a matter of fact. I drove a front-wheel drive version on Tuesday, drove an all-wheel drive version today.
Did the front-wheel drive feel any faster?
Not at all. Right. No, as a matter of fact, yeah, I didn't have the chance to really, we didn't get onto enough roads today in the all-wheel drive version where I could really flog it. But the front-wheel drive version, you could tell it was a little bit lighter, but not by much. I'd say maybe 200 pounds or so. So it was a little bit more tossable. It didn't quite feel quite as heavy in the rear. But overall, like I said, it was a really, really good, comfortable vehicle. Like I said, I think it's going to fit a lot of people's lifestyles. The kind of thing that I came away with, though, is, you know, with the crossover, kind of it's coming to the fore. Ford expects that it's going to overtake SUV sales by the end of the year, which I'm not entirely sure if I buy that, but judging by the numbers, they know what they're talking about. But the problem is there hasn't been a vehicle that's really defined the crossover segment yet, and they're hoping this is going to be it. They feel that their nearest competitor is the Nissan Murano.
Well, it's funny that they think that, and they talk about defining the segment with it, because
right.
From a lot of people in the industry that I talk to, is the Murano was the first CUV. I mean, that was really the first
definitely.
Example of a company trying to build something that was SUV-like, but mm-hmm. very car-like at the same time, and built on a unibody. So I think it's actually, pardon the pun, I think it's kind of bold that they would target the Murano.
It's their most obvious competitor, but at the same time, you know, you can go two ways. You can either go down market with like a CRV or a RAV4, which, you know, you're talking maybe about $2,000 or $3,000 more for the Edge versus a comparably equipped RAV4 CRV, or you're looking at going up market with the RDX or the Lexus RX series and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And, you know, it fits in very, very well between those segments, but I guess it's the perception, is Ford late to the party? Are they right on time? Are they
right.
ahead of the curve? Because, you know, I figure like with a CRV or RAV4, those vehicles have been around for, you know, a decade and a half now. They're not anything particularly new in the marketplace, and they've done well. There's no doubt about that. But are they considered a crossover? Are they considered, you know, a small SUV? The definitions is the biggest problem at this point.
I think Ford has a really good shot of defining a CUV with the Edge, because the Murano never sold in large enough numbers to kind of claim that title. It's just not well known enough.
No.
And these other vehicles that have been around for 6 years, they were labeled SUVs first. The RAV4, they were all, you know, called baby utes, soft roaders, whatever. But mm-hmm. people thought they were SUVs. And Ford has an opportunity, and so do other brands that come out with a completely new CUV right now.
Like GM, because they have the Acadia and the Outlook both coming.
Yeah, right. I think Ford has a better shot, though, because it's not as big as the Acadia. And I think mm-hmm. the bigger you go, the more people think SUV.
SUV, right.
And
I think that's the one thing the Edge really has going for it. It's a very, very distinct looking vehicle. I mean,
yeah.
it's got
great
the Ford
curb appeal.
DNA. Yeah, no, it's one of those vehicles that you know, we've seen the press photos and all that. When you actually see it in person, it's not a huge head turner, but when people look at it, they appeal. You know, we were driving, and I didn't notice a lot of people, you know, jerking their heads around to take a look at it. But whenever it was stopped, we had people looking at it pretty regularly, which is a good sign for Ford. But like I said, the styling, I think, and it's pretty low slung. I was actually talking to the chief designer, and he said, you know, it's a designer's dream, because it's low to the ground. The wheels are pushed out to all four corners. It's got low overhangs. It's exactly what they want.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it looks like a Range Rover Sport, and I think that's way to its benefit. It has a forward-leaning D-pillar. It's much lower to the ground than an SUV feels, and I think it has that kind of racer-back feel to it that, like I said, gives it really good curb appeal for what you're paying.
Well, while you're going out on a limb, I'm going to go out on a limb myself. And one thing that occurred to me about halfway through the day today was the fact that as people are starting to downsize from their SUVs, and the Edge and other crossovers kind of being the natural, I guess it would be the degression, wouldn't it? From there, I think this could be the beginning of wagon sales coming back. Because as people move down market from there, I see wagons becoming, you know, more recognized kind of in the European sense as utilitarian vehicles that provide everything they want. And, you know, what Ford's pushing so much with the Edge is it handles like a car, drives like a car. It's a
right.
unibody. It handles like that. And I'm kind of curious if this is going to kind of foretell the future in, like, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, whether or not that's going to be kind of a renaissance for wagons as well. I'm not holding my breath just because I've been in the American market long enough that wagons have never done particularly well here. But I think this could be a step in that direction.
Well, I look at it and I think, and actually this just came to me, I'll admit, yeah. but I think that the Edge has a shot of pulling off something similar to what the Taurus pulled off in 1986.
And they're certainly comparing it, yeah.
The reason I'll say that is because the Taurus wasn't an exceptional vehicle. I think, like you said before about the Edge, it's a perfectly average vehicle.
Yeah.
But they wrapped it in an exterior that was completely different than the boxes that were around at the time. And I think what Ford has done is taken all the perfectly average specifications and abilities and features of all these CUVs, and the problem with CUVs is that they are all over the place. You know, there's, I mean, technically, the PT Cruiser is a CUV, the RAV4 is a CUV. I mean, there's so many things that are a CUV, and Ford is going to be maybe the first to define it with a shape. And if they do that, maybe they can pull off something like the Taurus. I don't know. It's possible. Do I think it's going to happen? Not really.
Anyway, well, moving on to the whole designation of a crossover. GM's been having a problem with trying to figure out what really is a crossover, correct?
Yes. And actually, who did? Frank did this post.
Frank did that one, yeah.
Yeah, and basically, I kind of skimmed over the post, but it revolves around the GMC Acadia, Buick Enclave, and Saturn Outlook, and what to call these. Are they CUVs? Are they SUVs? And there was actually an example of GM changing the advertising for the SRX, the Cadillac SRX. When it first came out, they called it a CUV.
Right.
Or an SUV.
SUV, right.
Now they're pulling that advertising and calling it a CUV. And this was my point earlier, was that when CUVs first started to came out, or unibody-based SUVs, whatever you want to call them, people just called them SUVs. They just called anything with that shape an SUV. And now that there's this distinction, people don't know what to do. And they're starting to realize, I think, how few SUVs, true SUVs, are actually out there. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, we just have just an inordinate amount of CUVs that were right under our noses all this whole time. But it's turned out to be a marketing nightmare for the automakers. And quite honestly, I don't think average consumers know what the hell a CUV is. I don't think it enters their daily conversation at all, really.
No, the average consumer looks at the car and decides if they like how it looks, and that's a lot of the decision-making process right there. And they don't care what the marketing speak is, you know, behind it.
Now, I mean, you know, maybe GM and these other companies are just worried about if we start calling it a CUV in advertising, are we going to confuse a customer?
I think they should. I think that, in all honesty, they should stay away from anything involving UV because, you know, some customers are just going to be. I think they're going to go way over customers' heads. And SUV is so radioactive, as far as marketing terminology right now. Mm-hmm. I would just stay away from that whole, you know, three letter based nomenclature.
Yeah, but it's tough because, as a single automaker or a single ad agency, you can't really invent a name for a category. You know, people have tried. What do they call the X5, the SAV?
Yeah.
You know, right. It's like you can't.
That naming only appears in BMW advertising.
Right. I mean, it's like giving yourself a nickname. You just can't do it. You know. So it's tough. It's either call it a CUV or don't call it anything at all.
And just call it a crossover.
Yeah.
I think crossover sticks better, you know, in my opinion at least.
Mm-hmm. Is that what they mention in the article? Do they mention the word crossover?
That was in there, aside from...
They do say they call the SRX a crossover.
Right.
This is the problem is people, like you said, people look at a vehicle and decide if they like it. And by looking at a vehicle, most people can't tell whether it's a crossover or an SUV. You know, it's not an externally visual thing. It's you know, part of the mechanicals and what's underneath that makes it an SUV or a CUV. And you know, people like us can probably look at anything.
If it's body on frame or if it's unibody and all that. Yeah, definitely.
Right.
But that's not the average consumer, obviously.
Right. And speaking of the GM triplets, what do you guys think about these? Do you think it's badge engineering between the three? Do you think they're too big? Do you think they're just right?
I'll say from the Enclave point of view that there was a lot made of that when it debuted. I wasn't particularly smitten with it the first I'd seen it. It's kind of grown on me as I've seen more photos and seen Tiger Woods standing next to it and what have you.
That always helps.
Oh yeah, no, that's one of my defining characteristics. But anyway. But like I said, the Enclave is starting to stand out. I think that's probably one of the more forward-thinking designs we've seen, especially from Buick.
Definitely in recent memory. Yeah.
So I think that speaks well to their design department and how they're looking. I haven't seen much of this in the way of interior yet. The Outlook and the I really can't say much good about them, so I'm going to pass the buck on that one.
Yeah, you know, I think the Outlook looks the strangest of the three.
Yeah,
with its front fascia.
It's really busy up front.
Yeah, I don't think any of them necessarily look bad. I think they're all bigger than I thought GM would make this type of vehicle. I mean, this is meant to replace the Trailblazer in essence, and I think it kind of goes one step beyond the Trailblazer in size. These three vehicles are an example, I think, of the new GM. I mean, this is made with all new GM switchgear. I mean, all the high-tech engines, and this is kind of the turnaround GM that produced these three vehicles. So I'm kind of excited for them to try them out. I've only gotten to sit in them at a couple auto shows. So
yeah, I'm in the same place there as far as how much of them I've seen, but and I haven't seen the Acadia, you know, obviously, except in pictures yet.
Right.
But the Saturn, you know, the interior, like you said, it's the new GM interior, and it's pretty much all good compared to what GM interiors used to be, because it was like a nightmare before.
Right, yeah, and, I mean, they were the worst in the industry.
Oh, it was horrible,
honestly.
Yeah, and it was terrible. And as for the Buick, I think the Buick is actually pretty great because it really looks different from the other two.
It does.
I used the genetics, you know, the shared genetics between the other two are pretty obvious. You know, I mean, the front and rear fascias are different, but you look at those cars from the side and they look pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. But the Buick is very much its own thing, and I think that's really good for Buick.
I don't understand. I mean, I don't understand why companies can't just do that with every vehicle they're going to build off a platform. I don't understand why Ford and GM and to a great extent Daimler Chrysler can't say to themselves, all right, we're not going to share this vehicle among many brands unless we can make them truly distinct. You know, somebody in there needs to put their foot down. I mean, they do it in Volkswagen, Audi so well, mm-hmm. sharing the Golf platform among how many different vehicles, none of them looking anything alike.
I mean, look at the Seats. They don't even look like, they look nothing like their, you know, cousins, their corporate cousins.
Right. And obviously they figured out some business model to make this happen for each and every vehicle that sits on that platform. And for some reason we get, you know, Fusions and Milans that have different front ends, and we get what's the latest case of GM badge reengineering?
What's the minivan? Yeah, the name's escaping me right now.
Oh, the Terrazas and
those
the,
things cannot go away soon enough.
Oh, those are perhaps the worst vehicles on the road right now.
Awful.
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, those are those
when are, they added those on them. It was like I didn't understand what they were trying to even do.
No, and they didn't even have an unveiling. They just kind of showed up, and you could tell right from the get-go they were not proud of these vehicles at
it's
all.
Like, it's like when a movie opens without a critic screening, you know?
Or goes straight to DVD.
Right.
Doesn't even bother with the theaters.
Yeah. The basic instinct of automobiles, that's a bad sign, yeah.
Yeah.
Basic instinct, too. Anyway.
Well, speaking of the Saturn, we actually have a new car in the Autoblog garage. And Alex has the keys.
Yes, it's in the Alex Autoblog driveway right now. And I have an Aura, and it's pretty nice. I've only had it since yesterday, and I didn't really get to do any driving in it until today. But, you know, the
first impressions
early,
are good, though?
Your first impressions are good. It's got plenty of power. It looks good. You know, a couple neighbors have come by to look at it, too. And the response, you know, has been positive so far from the people that have seen it. And it'll get seen by a lot of people tomorrow because I'll bring it to my, you know, real life job, and get
what's that?
There.
Ew, yeah. Real life job.
But no.
That is the best test. Just bring it.
It's a nice car, I have to say, and it's a big difference from, you know, what Saturn was. I don't have a whole lot good to say about Saturn prior to now. I wasn't a big fan of really any of the products. And that all seems to be out the window, you know, in a very good way. And I think this car has a pretty good shot for them. You know, we'll see what plays out in the marketplace.
Did you get a sticker with it, a Monroney with it?
Yeah, I do.
What model did you get?
I have an XR.
Is that the top of the line one?
Yeah, that's the top of the line one. So it's got the high feature 3.6 liter with the 6-speed automatic. It's fairly loaded. It's got, you know, it's got leather. It's got XM. I mean, it seems like the option, it was pretty well optioned up. I mean, the only options.
What's the price come to?
The total price comes to $26,900.
That's not bad.
No, it seems like a lot of car for that money, to be honest with you. When I get in there and I sit in it and I look at it and I drive it, it's.
I mean, knowing how truly easy it is to option up in a quarter a Camry to $28,000 or $29,000. You know, any car, any midsize sedan fully loaded coming in at like 25 or 26 to me is impressive.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, it goes well. I'm looking forward to getting it on the highway tomorrow.
And this is 255 horsepower?
I believe so. I have to double check. I have to go look up the specs.
Probably the same 6-speed that's in the Edge. You know?
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree. It, just out of curiosity, one of my complaints with the Edge was the fact that it just had drive and then low. Is there any other gears in between D and L?
It's got drive and M so that you can use the paddles.
Oh, and, cool. Awesome.
The one thing, though, the paddle shifting, it works well, but I'm not crazy about how GM does their paddle shifters. You know, normally you would... you know, the instinct is right side is upshift and left side is down. With the GM setup, both paddles have identical functions, and peeking over the top of the steering wheel, you know, the center part of the wheel, you've got the little plus signs, and you hit those with your thumbs to upshift, and then you pull in the traditional sense either side to downshift.
But it's the same on either side.
Yes, it is.
That's ass backwards. That doesn't mean
The first time I put it into manual mode, and I couldn't get out of first gear, and I'm like, "What?" I couldn't understand what was going on. I felt like an idiot, and then I realized that I have to use my thumbs to push the little plus signs on the paddle on the top.
Are there any other manufacturers that are doing it that way?
I don't think so. I've never heard of that.
I mean, I've driven the Lexus, and Lexus has the traditional, you know, left side down, right side up.
And I've driven the A3, and that has the same thing as well.
And the Bentleys have that set up too.
The Bentleys
obviously.
Have that, yeah.
You guys are both bastards. You both drove Bentleys already. I'm kind of jealous anyway.
Listen, I had one for I did not have it for a weekend like John.
It was nice. I'm not gonna lie. It was nice. It was really nice.
Moving on.
We'll have another one soon. We'll have another one soon. So, but I'm gonna have to pass that one off to Alex.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think we have. I think they told us we have to wait until winter's over. They don't want to give us the new GTC while it's snowing out.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
no, that's not a good time for convertibles.
All right, our last story of the day, which is something I wanted to bring up because I'm all about diesel, as everybody knows, is Sunday was Ultra Low Sulfur Diesel Day, and it was it was October 15th, which is the day. That the feds basically said that all diesel sold in the U.S., or 80% of diesel sold in the U.S. had to be of the ultra-low sulfur variety. And apparently the switchover is actually going better than they thought, and over 90% of the diesel being sold is now the ultra-low sulfur variety, which... This fuel can be run in all the old diesel trucks, even, you know, diesel... Jettas and, you know, big rigs and buses, and it will actually yield an improvement in emissions. Although I've heard a lot of people are worried about what it's going to do to those older engines, whether it's going to clog the fuel system or whatever. But I guess we'll just have to wait and see. What we're waiting for are basically engines that are optimized, designed to take advantage of this fuel, which. couple are out. I think only Mercedes has the E320 BlueTEC as the only passenger car being sold right now, and it just went on sale, that would take advantage of it. But by January 1st, all diesel engines sold in the U.S. have to meet these new emission standards and be optimized to run this fuel. So it's kind of the next major step in our transition to much cleaner diesel, much stricter diesel regulations, and hopefully an influx of diesel engines for passenger vehicles from Europe into the U.S., which is something that I'm excited for. And obviously I can tell that you guys are just as excited as me.
Oh, man, we're freaking out over here. I've driven enough diesels by now that, you know, torquerific sometimes, but overall they're neat vehicles. But how many diesels have you driven, John?
Not that many.
Not that many. No, well, I mean, most of mine have all been Volkswagen and Mercedes.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I've driven a lot of Volkswagen and Mercedes. Actually, yeah. No, that's not true. I've driven many diesel pusher motorhomes in my day, which are great fun. Those are outstanding. just a complete trip and experience, an adventure to drive. White knuckle driving the whole time.
I've driven no diesels. I don't believe
in diesels. Oh,
it's gonna happen, man. It's gonna happen. They say by 2015,
something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. That 15% of sales are going to be diesels in the U.S. and they'll probably eclipse hybrids. Before that time.
Listen, you can't argue with the fuel economy aspect of the diesel engines. And like for the TDI Volkswagens are pretty impressive, the numbers that they're able to put up. Mm-hmm.
Like 600 miles on a tank.
That's insane. Come on.
Yeah. I mean. Good stuff. Okay, well, we have, I think, wasted enough of your time for this podcast. But before we go, as always, I want to give Volvo another chance to say a few
words.
Volvo
XC70 and XC90 deliver the ideal combination of versatility and comfort. They are both rugged and dependable, and come equipped with Volvo's advanced safety features. Visit www.volvocars.us for more information.
Okay, and before we let everybody go, I want to let our audience know of a new contest we're doing, which is pretty exciting because we hardly ever do contests. And it is the design or redesign our business card contest. And basically the idea is you redesign the Autoblog business card and or the Autoblog green business card. And we will pick a winner for both. And each winner will get a Pioneer AVIC D2 satellite navigation system valued at $1,500 a piece.
And so it's trick.
Yeah,
I got to play with one about 2 days ago. A friend of mine installs car stereos. He showed it to me, and it's pretty sweet. I got to say that.
It's a very, very nice prize. I'm happy we got it. And we really need our business cards redesigned because they're shameful. So I am more than happy to ask our readers' help in doing so. So it's very easy to enter a design. Just go to any website in the Weblogs Link network. We'd prefer you go to Autoblog, though. At autoblog.com, and at the very top of each page on the network is a link to the contest. So just hit that link, and it'll take you to the contest post where it has all the instructions, all the specifications that you need to adhere to. And basically, we're looking for designs that think outside the box. I mean, we all know what traditional business cards look like with a logo, contact info, and everything on white. And, you know, I'd like to see, I should say, outside-the-box designs that kind of move beyond that traditional white background. But I will say that some entries so far that have been the traditional type, some of them have actually surprised me, and they look much better than I thought somebody could get that traditional design to look. So you never know who's going to win, but the fact remains we need a new design for both the Autoblog business card and the Autoblog green business card. So if you know how to use Photoshop or Illustrator or any of those programs at all, and you want a $1,500 satellite navigation system, definitely enter the contest because you may have a very good shot of winning. And I think that is all. Oh, I should also mention, as we always do, if you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, just visit iTunes and do a search for Autoblog. You'll find us right in there. And, of course, visit autoblog.com every day where we have posts going up literally almost every half hour of the day because there's so much to cover. So definitely stop in and check back often. So until next week, everybody, have a good one.
Have a good week.
Bye, everybody.